very much for that thorough and accurate insight on my career. I perfectly explain I can't go down a job. my text today on the topic is not in sacred. It's taken from the late Lord Beaverbrook, owner of the Daily Express and the Sunday Express, a great journalist and a great propagandist. He wants to define the three qualities that were necessary to a good journalist as first, shorthand, second, typing, and third, low, rat-like cunning.
Thank you.
censorship in an undeclared and undebated war. Now, about that statement, we can make a number of points. First of all, there isn't actually a war on. Secondly, how would declaring a war make a difference as to the rights and wrongs of censoring information about troop deployments, which might be of use to a potential enemy like Iraq? Thirdly, the intervention, not the war, is debated, constantly debated. Fourthly, it is taking place in Saudi Arabia, where Saudi laws and cultures prevail, and there is no First Amendment. Five, the army classification of information is done under the laws of a democratic society, which determines who is and who is not entitled to receive information. Contrary to much press assertion, there is no right to know under the American Constitution. There is merely a strong presumption against prior restraint. So, on virtually no count, could it be said that Mr. Gardner had any, in a sense, reasonable complaint. Of course, he might have had a reasonable complaint along the grounds that there are a lot of trivialities that are being censored, and that this is unnecessary and foolish, and so on. But my favourite point on that score was when someone complained to, I think Sam Donaldson complained to the Defence Secretary, Mr. Cheney, that soldiers were appearing on television and wishing their parents and family well, but were not allowed to state their names. Whereupon Cheney said, well, I think their parents will recognise us. Now, Gardner's view and indeed Sam Donaldson's view, however, although it seems absurd in a way, it's nonetheless merely an exaggerated version of what is generally the press's opinion of itself. It is entitled to investigate anything and nothing is sacred from its intentions. But there is an exception to this relentless critical scrutiny of the press itself, from claiming that there should be no libel laws to public figures, to claiming benefit of clergy for reporters' notes, to demanding that the First Amendment as a justification either for ignoring any form of confidentiality in government or any privacy in private life. The press constantly claims a special status. It is a public watchdog, and it is entitled to pursue its investigations regardless of other rights, and indeed almost regardless of the consequences. This became the extent to which this is true. It became clear to me one day when I was taking part in a discussion of press rights and freedoms at the Columbia Journalism School in a group and a panel which included Jonathan Quinn, the investigative journalist, and Leslie Coburn, who made her name in some television investigations of the alleged Contra drug running plot. In the course of the debate, someone in the audience, I have to say it was a member of this society and a friend of mine who was there giving me first aid in case things turned out badly, a member of the audience raised the question when it was being asserted that the press had an obligation to publish anything to everything because of the right to know. Raised the question, supposing Mr. Quinney or Ms. Coburn had come up with information in 1940 that suggested, as we know, that the Roosevelt administration was working fairly closely with the British in order to bring about an entry into, not to bring it about, but to create the conditions in which it would be more likely that America would enter the war on the side of Britain and against Germany, as indeed subsequently happened. Now, if you would have published that information, the government pursuing an action which it was against its publicly stated policy, and which was obviously a matter of controversy within the United States, if you would have published that, remember, the assumption here is you have the goods. You have a front page story in every newspaper and the guidance of every television news broadcast, which will discredit President Roosevelt, desirable, I agree, on general grounds, but in this particular case, perhaps less so. And will perhaps, therefore, bring about a situation in which America remains aloof from the European war, denounces its win, and the history of the world is somewhat different. What do you do? Well, it was plain that this question had never occurred to any of the people on the panel. I accept myself to be, in fact, slightly different way. But it's not actually a very easy question to answer. It's not a black or white question. Because on the one hand, there is a public interest in uncovering government deception, which has to be borne in mind. But on the other hand, there is the necessity of a government that, during grave international crises, employing covert methods to bring about what it regards as the necessary interest of the United States. So there is something to balance here. But it wasn't that the people were concerned, that people were concerned about. They didn't, in a sense, they never faced up to the concept before that simply reporting a major story, which would embarrass the government, perhaps even bring it down, might have consequences that, from a larger standpoint, a larger historical standpoint, would be horrendous. So they had simply taken for granted that other people could take care of that situation. But when other people have taken care of that situation by passing laws which lay down the criteria for when a journalist can and cannot reveal something, or what he can and cannot reveal, they regard those laws as not applying to them. So in effect, they are quite literally claiming irresponsibility. In both senses of the term, they do not believe they should be responsible to anybody, and secondly, they feel free to act irresponsibly in relation to the consequences should, an ethic of investigation anyway. So you might say that the press has a right and duty to expose their fear, favor, or common sense. Well, let us accept that. The next question is it a public watchdog which acts in the public interest or in some private interest? Because this is crucial. Against the myth of the reporter on the side of the public, or the little guy, and or the organisations that claim to represent the little guy, such as Ralph Nader's various organisations, is the press, when it thinks it this way, acting as a public watchdog or in some other sense? The press plainly feels it's acting in the public interest. David Halbersham said, "I had always believed that journalism had a crucial role as the societal conscience of last resort." I would condemn that sentence on one number of grounds. One is that it uses the perfectly unnecessary word societal when we have a perfectly useful word social. Secondly, societal conscience sounds almost as ridiculous as societal worker. But that is the point of view which the press has to take. Now, if they are to be the public watchdog, they cannot, therefore, as a group, take sides. They must be, if not objective, because that might be beyond all our capacities, they must at least be impartial between different views held by the community. As journalists, therefore, we must know that there are different views, something which is the first step to being impartial between them. Then there are respectable arguments on both sides of such questions as abortion, foreign policy, government regulation of industry, supply-side economics, the defense build-up, and so on and so forth. Does the press meet this not very exacting standards? Well, there are various ways of looking. First of all, we can look at those press studies which try to examine whether or not there is such a thing as a bias in journalism. Rothman and Lichter, for example, which adopted anything like scientific methods, and Rothman and Lichter is the most famous one, they show consistently a press elite that is remarkably liberal in its private views. It's voted overwhelmingly democratic when the nation is voted overwhelmingly republican. It believes strongly in government regulation of industry and business. It is opposed to any regulation of private sexual behavior, including abortion. It regards U.S. foreign policy as basically exploitative of the third world, and so on and so forth. The Los Angeles Times did a study in 1985 which confirmed these findings. Indeed, as the country moved immensely right, so journalistic professions seem to have moved left. They studied a group of 3,000 reporters editors in newspapers, and they found that 82% were pro-choice on abortion, 89% supported affirmative action, 81% homosexual rights and hiring, and 26% only had voted for Reagan in the previous year. I think that these studies can be overdone, and there are, but nonetheless they are revealing in certain ways, and nowhere more so than in the area of moral questions, where there are some amusing curiosities. It's interesting, for example, that only 47% of the media elite thinks that adultery is wrong. Presumably 53% either don't know or believe it to be right, maybe even positive duty. Now, without some making any embarrassing public confessions, I'm an old-fashioned Catholic, not myself, I have to say I have known people who have committed adultery. And in discussing the question with them, they usually were prepared to concede that it was wrong, that it was the breaking of a vow, that it involved false promises maybe to the adulterous partner, that it was deceitful, and that in whether or not they intended to go on doing it, nonetheless, they could see from a general standpoint that it caused a lot of harm and unhappiness in the world. So the finding is open to the interpretation that in the media elite, we may just be dealing with an unusually innocent group of people. Now, I return to my main argument. I now go on to ask the question, yes, if the media is privately liberal, and it will admit this very often, how does it defend the case? And it defends it very interestingly. It says, we never allow other mediums to influence our work. There are lots of liberal plumbers, there are conservative woodworkers, when they get down to the job, they don't allow their opinions to affect their plumbing or woodworking, and neither do we. See, there are some journalists who go to the left of not voting. They think it might influence them. As if opinions which you don't know you hold are not more likely to influence you than those which you are consciously aware of. So, we therefore have to ask, granted that they are liberal, what is the evidence that their story is showing bias, either conscious or unconscious? Well, take first those cases in those stories in which you see the expert quoting some question like whether the Reagan boom is being good for the country or bad for it. There'll always be, it'll always open with a guy called Joe Sixpack. He's not the expert. He's been out of work for 6 months and now he realizes that Reagan's a bad thing. But then later on in the story, there's an expert quoting. Now, Rothman and Lichter did some very interesting work here. They asked the journalists to name reliable sources on a whole range of questions. Government regulation, the environment, nuclear power, welfare, and so on. And in almost every case, the journalists' questions overwhelmingly cited liberal sources like Ralph Nader or the National Resources Defense Council or so on as reliable sources whom they would turn to for the definitive view of some question, which they would then report to their readers as the judgment. They were, in fact, 3 or 4 times as likely to cite such a source as to cite, say, someone as moderate as Daniel Patrick Moynihan on welfare. He was cited as a conservative source, and he apparently actually a Muslim for more than half the conservative responses given by the journalists. Now, so if you go on the basis of who journalists cite in the stories when they think they're being impartial, they are 3 or 4 times as likely to cite liberal as conservative sources. Now let me turn to another way of approaching the question. I'm going to take a few case studies of what I regard as bias. And I make no claim that these are scientific. I say merely that they reveal the kind of thinking and errors of interpretation which occur when a worldview is generally shared among a profession and when it is not subject to correction by critical discussion and internal argument. Let me examine, first of all, a case study of the US role in world affairs, particularly its role in combating terrorism. Now, you may remember in the middle 80s, there was a great deal of argumentation that the United States was crippled and frustrated in dealing with terrorism. It was faced by this challenge, which it couldn't really cope with effectively. Governor Reagan, President Reagan, rhetoric on this score was often exaggerated. He was promising things he couldn't achieve, and he would not succeed. So I want to examine how the press treated one case of this, and one case which in retrospect seems an almost a model example of how the correct way to deal with terrorism, namely, successfully done, namely the capture of the Achille Lauro hijackers who had killed Leon Kinghoffer in 1985. You may remember their plane was brought down in Sicily. Well, this represented, at first sight, a remarkable wreckage of liberal theory on terrorism. After all, the US, by decisive action, had defied all the confident, defeated assertions that it had no options in the fight against terrorism except restraint. It had employed force. It had treated diplomatic considerations as secondary. It had triumphed. None of this was supposed to happen. And for a moment, it disconcerted the establishment of liberal media. But only for a moment. When I read the editorials in the press over the following weekend, I found myself astonished and admiring at their brilliant recovery. It was as if even two soldiers, scattered and in the utmost confusion after a direct artillery hit, had almost instantly returned to their position and were soon marching, counter-marching, wheeling, and carrying out the most intricate parade ground maneuvers in perfect harmony. The first maneuver was the most brilliant and the most ruthless. They welcomed the U.S. interception in the warmest terms. It was, the New York Times, exhilarating. It was, the Washington Post, splendid. Not a hint of reservation in the tributes. Indeed, they thought so highly of the action that they assumed instinctively that it must have been carried out by someone other than the Reagan administration. This was the only false step the editorialist made in an otherwise brilliant display of reinterpretation. Saturday's editorial in the New York Times referred to the interception as more than an American victory. It was apparently the work of three governments, the Italian, the Egyptian, and the American, acting in secret concert. Even Arab at the time speculated probably been persuaded by Bettino Craxi, the Italian Prime Minister, to acquiesce in turning the hijackers over to justice. Actually, this was a sort of reverse prediction, since Arafat actually persuaded Craxi to release the PLO hijack organizer a few days later. And the Washington Post outlined the same scenario with a nod and wink passage in its own Saturday editorial. Quote, whether Egypt contributed further by joining a plan that let it make good on its felt obligation to fellow Arabs, while at the same time allowing the capture of the terrorists, is a question not likely to be suppressed by official denials. Well, that's pretty good, really, because when there are official denials, because you told people that it's not likely to be suppressed by the intrigues, some intrigues posited in the editorials, were plainly what the editorialist hoped it happened. But was there any evidence? Well, the reporters had got digging, and one has to actually say that there is a kind of residual reporting job which you have to do, which sometimes compels you to act against your opinion. And they established very conclusively that President Barak had lied to Reagan, and that Craxi was wriggling furiously to find some respectable way of releasing Abbas behind him. The Times then had to make amends. Mr. Reagan's achievement was thus born in the most appalling failure of friendly governments to stand together against the common danger, and the Post followed suit the following day, which ended the press's flirtation with the idea that international cooperation, rather than in unilateral US action, could solve this particular crisis. So a logical next step beckoned. If US action had solved the crisis, that clearly indicated that this was a most unusual crisis. A unique crisis. A crisis which provided no lessons for the future. And guess what? It was. It is summing up of the crisis in the New York Times Weekly Review that an article about the future concluded. The circumstances of the seizure of the Italian liner and the apprehension of those who carried it out were not typical of terrorist organized operations. aspirations and are not likely to be repeated at any time soon. The Washington Post mumbled along. Chain of circumstances provided Mr. Rain with a rare opportunity, but conclusions must be sparingly drawn. Over the next few days, the reasons why the US interception provided no future lessons were then very carefully laid out. It had required a minimum of international cooperation from Italy and Tunisia. That might not be forthcoming in the future. It had not risked the lives of hostages who were free by the time of the interception. The hijackers, trapped in a plane rather than able to escape from that hijack, were vulnerable. Because we'd known their identity, we could mount precise operation to seize them. That was legal, but since it didn't harm innocent bystanders, it was moral in a way that a retaliatory strike against the terrorist camp would not have been. In fact, by a wonderful hocus pocus, it could even be argued that this wise and wonderful success was actually an argument against any future anti-terrorist actions. The New York Times. The Reagan administration's passage from aimless shelling of the chute at Lebanon last year to the carefully calibrated aerial interception in the SS of Sicily may mark our collective passage from cluster to mature self-defense. President Reagan had broken. Now, laid anywhere, these arguments may sound fairly impressive, but what they look like when you look at them simply. First, it's actually harder to apprehend terrorists who are flying around the Mediterranean than to attack them in camps which are in a particular place. Second, attacks on terrorist camps require little or no international cooperation, be they Israel. That's particularly true for the Mediterranean, which with the presence of the US 6 feet is virtually an American lake. Thirdly, the guilty men are not confined to people who actually plan the bombs and hijack ships. They include those who plan the operations, trade the hijacks, buy the guns, maintain the entire infrastructure that makes terrorism possible. This is true even under normal criminal law. It's doubly true under the rules of war. A legalistic approach to terrorism, which the newspapers were always advocating, is an absurd one. It amounts to arguing that an army can only return fire on those individual soldiers in opposing trenches who have actually been observed sniping at foot in New York Times, I suppose, if you actually know what their identities are. It would rule out bombing raid on the enemy's headquarters on the grounds that this is illegal and unjustified, retaliatory action of an imprecise kind. And finally, the rules of war dictate that although care should be taken to avoid harming civilians, their presence at a legitimate military target does not morally prohibit an attack upon it. If it did, terrorists would permanently surround themselves with innocent civilians. What I have to say is that what exactly are innocent bystanders doing in a terrorist camp? And so on and so forth. The whole report of the episode was designed and indeed succeeded in arguing that this couldn't have happened, shouldn't have happened, but since it had happened, it must happen again. Now, that reaction has been replaced by quite a different one in the current crisis. Since the US intervention in the Persian Gulf began, and since it's generally popular, I know it's controversial in conservative circles, we in National Review have taken a particularly strong line, which has also been controversial, and you may wish to raise that later. But it is generally popular in the country as a whole. Since then, the press has been agonizing that maybe the reason is that this is because the press has not been skeptical enough. This is very similar to an argument we heard a few years ago in the mid-80s, that President Reagan was popular because the press had been insufficiently critical of him. Now, this argument in relation to the Persian Gulf says a number of things. One, it's an assumption that is hostile to the use of American power. It's an assumption that to be hostile to the employment of American power is the normal and proper reaction of people, and that any other reaction needs somehow to be explained. Secondly, it assumes that the public is a tabula rasa on which the press writes an opinion. It does not have opinions of its own. It merely reflects what it's told. And third, it's an argument that the press should try to produce particular effects by its writing. A more sober view of the war by taking a particular attitude, namely press skepticism. None of these arguments are justified or are common among journalists. Now, a second ban of abortion. Now, Richard Hartwood, the ombudsman of the Washington Post, has already made half my point in a very famous article which most of you, I think, will be familiar with, in which he termed the coverage of abortion, of demonstrations for and against abortion in his paper as biased, because, and he admitted that the anti-abortion demonstration had not been given proper attention, the other was the other being given. And he gave an explanation for that, which I think is actually very plausible, which is that Washington Post reporters live in a world in which they never met anyone who was against abortion. They therefore thought that abortion was, the opposition to abortion was an eccentric minority opinion held by people out there, somewhere away from civilization, and that therefore their opinions were of no account. And that, it's, we don't call that an opinion, is more a question of a sort of, it's more a matter of ideological osmosis, but it biased the coverage of the paper. But what are we to say of a bias so profound that it determines attitudes even when the reporter in question or the writer in question is making a deliberate attempt to be impartial? Here is a sentence from the Washington Post style book, pages 185 and 186, I'm grateful to the media world for pointing this one out to me, in which the author lays down the Washington Post reporters the correct way to use terms to describe the performance against abortion. I quote. The terms right to life and pro-life are used by advocates in the abortion controversy to buttress their arguments. They should generally be used as part of an organization's title and in quotations, but not as descriptive adjectives in the text. Use abortion rights advocates for those who support freedom of choice, anti-abortion for those who oppose it. Now, what's being done there is that somebody, even when they're making an effort to be impartial, cannot see the bias in denying the loaded term right to one side in a national controversy while awarding it to the other side as a sort of extra. Now, there are also some, and it is that kind of bias, unconscious and resistant even to deliberate reflection, which again biases the national press on a whole range of moral questions. Now, I think there are also biases in relation to communism and anti-communism and foreign policy, and I think perhaps that in the time is moving on, I should wait for any questions if you want to raise that. Now, briefly, therefore, to just conclude the two points. One, try to explain this, and secondly, to wonder if there are any remedies. Explanation. Well, a bias which is liberal in morals, economics, and foreign policy creeps into the most press TV coverage, despite criticism and conscious attempts to prevent it. Why? Warren Brooks has argued, basing his arguments on political choice, public choice theory, James Buchanan, that journalists have an interest in big government. Since they cover it, the bigger the government, the bigger the stories. And they also, for the same reason, tend to reflect the interests of their big government sources who supply them with news. I don't deny that there's something in that argument. I think probably there's an element of that explaining why reporters unconsciously look favorably on big government, a liberal in that narrow sense. But I don't think it's a wholly convincing argument. Notice that the journalists who cover the Pentagon are by and large not enthusiasts for military buildups. They have not been persuaded by their interests in a larger military role, or by the interests of their sources. They respond to the opinions not of their sources, but of their colleagues in the newsroom and on the news desk. Also, those colleagues are the people who decide whether they're promotional. Secondly, journalists treat their sources somewhat differently according to the opinions those sources generally represent. Look, for example, at the example of the Secretary of State, Mr. James Baker. He gets kid glove treatment almost all the time. Notice how he has been assigned very little blame indeed for the supposed not to be kosher, but nonetheless, in his case, it didn't help. Public choice would not, public choice theory would not explain the bias employed in the post-style or compulsion. So how do we explain it? Well, I myself think, and I joke in nature, this is more an expert than this, I will ever be in my, or say something about this later, but I myself think that it's partly a result of self-selection. Liberal young people join the profession because they've learned from Watergate and from Lou Brown that it is a liberal profession where they'll be at home. And there is some evidence, again in Rotten and Lichter, that younger journalists tend to be even more liberal than their older counterparts. I would also suggest that any such bias is likely to be strongly reinforced by the journalists, most of the journalists, which are generally hotbeds of liberal opinion, which sometimes presented to people in the guise of professional journalistic standards. It's interesting, incidentally, that a study of Columbia Journalism School students showed that 85% described themselves as political liberals, 11% political conservatives. Only 4% were in favor of any form of regulation of abortion, and 75% thought the US was responsible for third world poverty. So, my experience with the Columbia Journalism School was quite an amusing one. I was on the New York Post as an editorial page editor when I was there. New York Post, of course, was regarded by them as a disgraceful paper, partly because it had headlines like "Granny Gets AIDS" and "Headless Body in Top as Well," which I mentioned on the grounds that it wasn't top as well, but he didn't have a head. It was a perfectly accurate headline. What were they complaining about? I don't know if I'm responsible for the headline, but I would have been proud to be responsible. I was asked by, after a long talk, I was asked, I subsequently checked, so in all sincerity and all honesty, no irony intended, that since I was now in a senior editorial position on the New York Post, would I be ever able to get a job in journalism again? The general view, of course, at school being that the only sort of journalism was respectable local Washington Post journalism. Now, solutions, I'm not sure that there are any. I would myself say that all of those actions, other than the Media Watch Institutes, are extremely useful. Anything which establishes the press and television to constant criticism and holds people to account for their views and mistakes is good. I would suggest, for example, that in Britain there's one television programme which might be usefully imitated here, which does precisely that. It's called What the Papers Say. It's a journalist, a different journalist every week, comes on and for a quarter of an hour examines the stories in that week's papers. It's generally a very amusing programme. In other words, he tries to poke fun at them as well as correct their errors. And it is quite an humour and mockery are a very effective method of correction, as everyone has ever dealt with a sarcastic teacher in school will recall. So the first is to encourage the spread of institutes and programs which subject the press to that kind of criticism. The unfortunate thing is that although the initial institutes of that kind tend to be conservative, there's now a whole set of bogus ones which claim to detect conservative bias in the press, which is really absurd and nonetheless, the press, I noticed, seems to pay more attention to it and is relieved to be attacked from the left. Secondly, I think what one needs in journalism is more New York Posts. One of the great differences between journalism and the general opinion in Britain and the United States is that the existence in Britain of a strong, popular, tabloid, right-wing, conservative press has a very important effect upon social opinion. It means that conservative views have more determined much more effectively the way society goes. Now, you probably won't recall this, but a few years ago, one of the major elements in conservative propaganda was the loony left councils who were ruling Britain. So the councils in North London, which were establishing things like a gay lesbian chorus, widow leagues, taxpayers' money to it were subjected to mockery and attack in the Sun and the Daily Mail. This very major political issue. The Tory party itself ran the story, and I remember on one occasion during the election campaign, as the Prime Minister's speech were particularly loud, first applause, somebody turned to me and said, I never thought I'd live to see the day when an attack on lesbianism would be an applause line at a Conservative Party conference. But the use of socially conservative attitudes and patriotic attitudes in popular right-wing press were a very important element in making Britain somewhat more conservative society than it would be. And the same would I'm sure apply here. The fact is that, with few exceptions, there are not such papers. And the existence of the journalism schools is partly designed to ensure that those such papers never exist. Thirdly, and most importantly, one of the most vital things is that there should be increasing numbers of television stations, newspapers, and magazines. The more, the merrier. The more there are, the less power the media elite has. If you have 20, if you have cable, satellite, and terrestrial television, it's 35 channels instead of, it's 35 channels instead of 3 or 4, then the influence of those who are on 3 or 4 diminishes enormously. And indeed, the left realizes this very well indeed, because, again tomorrow, taken from the British experience, there is an enormous attack in Britain at the moment on the deregulation of television, which is designed to increase the number of channels available, on the specific ground that if this happens, the BBC's influence will be diluted. And so it will. And so it will be a good thing. And the same thing is already happening here more naturally, more easily, because of the constitutional arrangements in these matters. But it's something which is, in a sense, the strongest strongest corrective influence on newspaper liberals. Finally, I suppose, and this is my conservative optimism coming out, maybe one simply shouldn't worry all that much for this reason. People don't read all this innocently. We all bring our biases to what we see and read and listen to. And very often, the most dedicated propaganda completely misfires because people watching it, in a sense, their minds deliberately reinterpret what they're told. The classic case of this, and one of the first pieces of it, consumer journalistic research of this kind, was in 1948, when Truman was running against the Taft Party, among other things against the Taft Party Act. There was an investigation into those people who liked Truman and intended to support him, but who were also in favor of the Taft Party Act, which he was denouncing at every major speech he made. And it was discovered by the researchers that the people in question did not realize that Truman was against the Taft Party Act. They thought he was a good guy. They thought it was a good thing. Therefore, he must be in favor of it. There are, in every general election that takes place in this country, about 6 or 7 standard percent of people who lived through a year and a half of harassment has and never realized there is an election going on. One wonders how they get by. But nonetheless, they do. Very few people pay as much attention to what they see and hear on television and newspapers as you and I do. We see every bias that there is, maybe one or two biases that are not really there. But most people either don't see it at all because they don't take it in, or they misperceive what they do take in, and consequently, the propagandistic effect simply doesn't work. And that doesn't mean to say it's a good thing. It's a bad and unhealthy thing in a free society that one set of opinions should be unnaturally protected and another set of opinions unreasonably dismissed. We shouldn't allow journalistic or media to get away with this, and we should respond to what they do by